this morning is, if you're visiting or you weren't here last week, this morning is a continuation of last week's lesson. I didn't have enough time for all of it, and so hopefully you're not at too much of a disadvantage, but I think that you should be able to get something out of this, as hopefully you will anyway. The lesson this morning, I don't want to say it's unconventional because I wouldn't say that, but I'm going to be bringing in some sources from outside, and so hopefully you learn a little bit, and maybe more than you would have in some other cases. We will turn to plenty of passages, so don't worry about that. But we're going to look at a lot of things that others have to say about what we're studying about. And what we're studying about is the sin of anxiety. And we'll recap in a second. But last week we looked at what the Bible has to say about it. And this week we're going to spend the entire lesson talking about the world's solution for anxiety. What does the world say that we should do for anxiety? So I want to put this verse in front of you here in Psalm 94. You don't have to turn there. You can read it up here. Here the psalmist says, "Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? Unless the Lord had been my help, my soul would soon settle in silence. If I say, my foot slips, your mercy, O Lord, will hold me up. In the multitude of my anxieties within me, your comforts delight my soul." So here we see that he has a lot of reason to be afraid, but he's going to let the Lord comfort his soul. One of the things that I want to notice, though, in particular for tonight's lesson, or for this morning's lesson going forward, is the fact that anxieties well up in the soul. And if you believe the soul is the not physical part of man, then this becomes very important for what we're going to study this evening. The Bible has a lot to say about anxiety, and we covered much of it last week, but there's a lot more. And I encourage you to look it up if you need something to study. Of course, there's a lot of anxiety at this time. There's a lot of people who are very anxious in the world and also in the church. So for a recap, we noticed last week, we looked at how anxiety does not allow us to be humble. We looked at 1 Peter chapter 5, where he says, "Humble yourself before God, and he will exalt you in due time, casting your anxiety upon him, for he cares for you." Whenever you cast your care upon him, then you have to humble yourself. And we looked at how that is. We looked at examples of anxiety in the scriptures and how that in all of the cases that it caused them to no longer be humble. For example, it caused Martha to accuse the Lord. "Do you not care for me?" If you're anxious about what it is that if you're anxious about physical things and physical care, then what you're saying is, "I don't think God can take care of me." Or, "I think I can take care of myself better." And so we looked at a lot of these examples last week, and we don't have time to go back over them. But we looked at God's cure for anxiety, and that's found in Philippians chapter 4, where he says, "If you're anxious, then you need to go to God in prayer and be thankful." Why thankful? We thought about that for a minute, because if you are truly thankful, then it's impossible to be self-centered. You start thinking about other people, and you start thinking about what they have done for you and how much you needed that. It's impossible to be truly thankful if you're thinking about yourself. And then finally, the passage there that we all turn to, "Think on these things," right? "Whatsoever things are good and true and honest and so forth, think on these things." If you take something out, you have to put something back of your mind and your heart. And then finally, we closed up with Christ's example and how that he was in agony, suffering there in the garden. He had to pray over and over, and his body was reacting to what was going to happen to him with sweat, as if drops of blood. It was going to be hard, but he never allowed it to turn to anxiety because he cast that upon the Lord. And what did he say? He said, "Not my will, but thine." And so he was able to make it through because he had a job to do, and he got it done with the Lord's help. And so this is what we looked at last week, and I promise you that this week we would look at the world's cure for anxiety. The world tells you that they know what to do for anxiety, and how that they can help you to get through it. And so this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about the world's what the world's solution for this might be. Now, whenever I was in graduate school, my research supervisor was very adamant that science was the answer for all of the world's problems. Science was the cure for all the world's problems. He put this everywhere. It was on his bio. I believe that science is the cure for all of the world's problems. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with science. A lot of people are like, oh, science is evil or science is bad. And I don't believe that. I am a scientist. And I don't believe that. I believe God created science just like he created everything else. And so therefore, it's not science that is bad. It's the way that people are doing it. Just like religion, right? Religion isn't wrong, but sometimes people are in error or they do it wrong and not the way that God prescribed. And so we see that in science. It's mostly overcome by people who are doing it wrong because they're not doing it from the right mindset. And I'm going to show that to you this morning. So I want to thank I definitely want to thank Cody for leading the songs. I picked out all of his songs for him this morning, and I really appreciate him leading those. They all go exactly with the lesson this morning, in particular the last one that we sang, Our God, He is Alive. And the verse that always gets to me is there where he talks about life and how that he holds the life that is in, that is, he holds the secret to life, and only he, you know, not chemical reactions, and we didn't begin as a series of chemical reactions, and we'll explore that in just a moment. But this idea of science being able to cure everything, so we'll look at what science's cure for anxiety is, and contrast that to what we learned last week about the Bible's cure. So I want to define a few things this morning. This idea of materialism. Materialism is a worldview. And y'all know what a worldview is? A worldview is how you frame everything that you believe. Okay? A worldview is the scaffolding that you hang everything you believe on, the prism through which you see everything. So there's a worldview that philosophers call materialism, and that is defined by Merriam-Webster's dictionary, the belief that only material things exist. And this is science today, and in fact, this is the majority of the world. They've been so convinced that God doesn't exist and that there's not a spiritual part of man, that only physical things exist. And so this leads to a set of teachings called naturalism, okay? Naturalism. Naturalism is the doctrine that scientific laws are adequate to account for all phenomena. For all phenomena. Everything must be able to be distilled down to something physical that can be touched and measured and observed. Scientific laws. That's the definition of scientific laws. Notice that it says the doctrine. This is a teaching. It's a belief system. It's a teaching. And we're going to examine that a little bit further as we go this morning. So the doctrine that scientific laws are adequate to account for all phenomena. Is that true? If that's true, then people have no choice in the way that they are. You have no choice whether you're good or whether you're evil. You have no choice. If this is true, then you are completely and totally a product of whatever it is that scientific laws have made for you. And you have no spirit, you have no soul, and you have no hope of eternal life with God in heaven. And we, of all men, are most miserable because there is no resurrection. There's nothing after the body dies, right? So the doctrine that scientific laws are adequate to account for all phenomena. So what I want you to take away this morning, even though we're going to look at all of these details, and I'm going to give you plenty of details, I'm going to give you examples, and we're going to look at the Bible, but one thing I want you to take away, if nothing else, because I want you to start thinking a little more critically, is that everything you read or you hear or is discussed about science, even on the news or on the internet or in school, it doesn't matter. It presupposes materialism. Okay? It presupposes materialism. It presupposes naturalism. And I'll show you that in just a second. This is really key as a Christian, because if you don't realize this, then things are going to slip through your defenses. So here's an example. Scott Todd, he was at the Department of Biology, Kansas State University, whenever he wrote this. This has been quite a while back, but it's still true today. Even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. So remember naturalism. Everything must be able to be measured. Whenever you read about science, this is the framework within which they operate. Such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. Now, you realize that this means that science, or naturalism, I should say, naturalism can never be proved to be true. Because if you exclude a priori the fact that there's a God, you just say, I'm not going to believe that, and I'm not going to investigate that, and I'm not going to think about that. It's not a possibility. If you never test that, then you can never prove that this is actually true, because you've already excluded part of the space of investigation. So intellectually, this is actually a very dishonest and kind of lazy way to think. Well, I'm not sure that we can discover God naturalistically, so we're just going to act like he's not there. This is very common in science. Very common to make these types of assumptions and just say, hey, everything fits in this box and so forth. But this is the basic premise of science. Number one, there is no God, and so everything else must be able to be explained by that. The more we know of evolution, the more unavoidable is the conclusion that living things are produced by a natural, totally amoral process with no indication of a benevolent creator. David Barash, evolutionary psychiatrist, University of Washington. Darwin's theory undermined the foundations of the entire Western way of thinking about the place of our species in the universe. Whenever you read Western, read Judeo-Christian. Judeo-Christian values. Nature eliminates the unfit and preserves the fit. It is man who has caused all the trouble. He has put his whole soul into saving the unfit. Do y'all realize what the unfit is? So Darwin came up with this idea. He called it the law of natural selection. Natural selection. He called it a law, which I think is presumptive, because even his followers don't call it a law, they call it a theory, and I would call it a hypothesis. But the thing about natural selection is you have two kinds of organisms, the fit, and the fit get to live, okay? But the unfit, they die. All right? This is natural selection. The problem with this is that as you go through time, the fit eventually become unfit, and they die too. The whole doctrine of Darwinism, the whole doctrine of natural selection, and that whole hypothesis is a theory of death. It's all about death. Everything is death. Whenever you read the literature on this and you study it, it's all about death. The more death you have, then the more you can refine the fit. This is completely antithetical to the way that we are as Christians, where we are concerned about life and the resurrection. This is completely incompatible with the way that we believe. But this idea of the fit, he says here that man has caused all the trouble because he has put his whole soul into saving the unfit. Isn't this what Jesus came to do? To save the unfit? To heal the sick? The great physician didn't come to heal the healthy, but to heal the sick. So you see what this is? You have the elect and the not elect, right? So even whenever they try to perform a completely naturalistic way of thinking, they still circle back around to religion now, don't they? And this is a theme that we'll see throughout this lesson. Man has put his whole soul into saving the unfit because that is the noble thing to do, is to lift up those who need help, not throw them under the bus, not kill them. Edward East, biologist, Harvard University. How about this one? At some future point, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races. Now, I'll leave it up to your imagination what the savage races are, but I'm surprised that today's cancel culture hasn't started on Darwin yet. But we'll see if that ever happens, right? How about this one? If you think it's all about science, look at this. All that progressives ask or desire is to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. What does he mean by that? Well, Karl Marx said that Darwin has finally given us a scientific basis for the class struggle. Okay? You see how Darwinism creeps into all of the facets of our lives, and we might not even think about it. People are interpreting laws based on this type of idea. Now, while we were going through this, did you notice how many of these people were in academia? This is a big deal. This is a big deal. I've said it before. I will continue to say it over and over and over again, that schools are the killing fields for our children. The slaughter places. At least 70% of Christians who go to college will not make it through it. And now you know why. Because this permeates everything. Everything about it. Everything. And you don't want to be, you know, whenever you are confronted with all of this evidence for why this is true over and over and over again, you might begin to believe it. It might chip away at you and slowly, slowly kill you. So again, everything you hear or read about science, even on the local news, presupposes materialism. And maybe not even science, maybe other fields as well. I don't want to make this a lesson about Darwinism, but I do want to look at a couple of passages because they're going to be key for what we're going to talk about next. Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 11, or looking at verse 11, notice what he says here about this. He says, "And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so." Notice what he says there, yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself. Verse 12, "And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good." 21. Verse 21, it says, "And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good." Verse 24, "And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of earth after his kind, and it was good." Verse 25, "And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and God saw that it was good." So we see that that everything that was created reproduced after its own kind, right? We don't get new kinds and new things from the things that God created. And this is reinforced in chapter 6 of Genesis. Chapter 6 and verse 20. He says, "Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing of the earth after his kind." This is talking about the creatures that are going to go into the ark. "Two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive." And 7 verse 14 says, "They and every beast after his kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and every fowl after his kind, every bird after of every sort, and they went in unto Noah unto the ark." Okay? Why? Why is this important? This is telling us that even after the reset of the great flood, that the reason all of these organisms, all of these animals, and all of these creeping things, the reason they needed to go into the ark was because there would be no further diversification after they came out, right? Only the things that live would be able to procreate and so forth. So in other words, let me say it the other way around. Everything that lives today has a direct ancestor on the ark. Everything that lives on the land, anyway. It's important because, you know, if evolution were true, God could have saved one or two different types of animals and then diversified everything after that, right? But he didn't. He saved everything after its kind because everything reproduces after its own kind. And today, as much as they would like you to believe otherwise, today, scientifically, no one has ever observed a new species coming into being. Never. So this is important because everything you hear or read about science, even in the local news, presupposes materialism. And this permeates us so much that a lot of times I think we don't even understand what's going on. In fact, I would suppose that most of you here this morning, unless you're exceptionally clever, which some of you may be, and that's great, you have accepted, without thinking about it, at least some premise of evolution. If not this morning, whenever you were reading the news, then yesterday, whenever you were surfing the internet, or maybe previously in this week. Because it permeates so much, and we're so used to hearing it, we just kind of go with it, and we don't really think about it. And this is what's dangerous. This is why it's so dangerous in school. Because we saw psychology, biology, economics, all of these sciences and all of these studies, evolution permeates it, even if they don't overtly say it. And you say, how is it, why is it, Jacob, that you can so confidently say that I accepted the premise of evolution, or at least didn't notice it whenever I was presented with it? Well, you've heard the language of the disease that's going on right now, and you've heard them talk about the novel coronavirus, right? The novel coronavirus. They're talking about evolution. They're talking about evolution. This thing just evolved, and man has not yet evolved immunity to it. And this is their entire argument. This is why it's so bad and so scary. And so we see survival of the fittest, right? Natural selection going on in real time, according to them. Now, if you did recognize this as evolution, then I've got a prize for you. Back whenever I was teaching students in college, I used to put stickers on their papers whenever they did exceptionally well. So I brought my stickers this morning, and I have dinosaur stickers here for you. And come see me afterward if you realize that they were talking about evolution. You say, were they really talking about evolution? Well, let's go to the scientific literature and let's find out. So here's a study that just came out, I think it was like 2 weeks ago or something like that, in Nature Microbiology. So Nature Microbiology, Nature is like the top scientific journal in the world. Now, I don't know if you understand the way science is done, but the way science is done, and someday I'll offer a more detailed talk about this at some point, either in class or in a lesson or something, but the more prestigious and exclusive that your journal is, then the more true it is, whatever you put in it, okay? And this is the way scientists think. But notice what they say here, that the study is titled Evolutionary Origins of the SARS-CoV-2 Sarbecovirus Lineage Responsible for the COVID-19 Pandemic. So this is a quote from the abstract of that paper, published in Nature Biology 2 weeks ago or so. Bayesian evolutionary rate and divergence state. Okay, what is divergence? This is the concept of speciation in evolution. Okay, so you had this organism, and then another species evolved out of it. So that's what they're saying here. Bayesian evolutionary rate and divergence date estimates. So they think they can pinpoint exactly when this thing evolved. Were shown to be consistent with evolutionary rates based on HCoV-OC43, that's a cold virus, and MERS-CoV. Divergence dates between SARS-CoV-2 and the bat sarbecovirus reservoir, that is the ancestor, the evolutionary ancestor of it, were estimated as either 1948, 1969, or 1982, indicating that the lineage giving rise to SARS-CoV-2 has been circulating unnoticed in bats for decades. So what they're saying here, and actually they're surprised. They think that if it evolved that long ago, it should have already, you know, been affecting humans, and they're really surprised about this. But you see how novel means recently evolved? The novel coronavirus that recently evolved, and man has not yet evolved to adapt to it. So I want to show you the graphic from their paper that I thought that was interesting. And on the left you have, I don't know if you can read it, it's really tiny, but on the left you have the year 1200, and all the way over to the right you have present day. And so the blue is MERS-CoV, and the red is the lineage leading up to SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 virus. So what's interesting to me about this is that there's basically no evolution for a long time, and then bam, there's a bunch of evolution last century. And I'm not a geneticist, and I learned a bit by reading these papers, but to me this doesn't pass the laugh test. I would look at this and say, what? This doesn't make any sense. You would expect evolution to be relatively constant, right, through time. And in fact, I've put up here the only illustration from Darwin's On the Origin of Species, and I've turned it sideways. He had it the other way. I've turned it sideways because this is kind of what they're trying to show in theirs. Darwin showed all of his evolutionary nodes to be basically consistent and spaced out because that's what's more reasonable. But as they go through this, they presuppose evolution, and so they work backwards trying to find that in the data. You see how this works? And so where do they get this idea from? Well, this idea is actually nothing new. Louis Pasteur was a very big proponent of evolution, as in pasteurization. He's considered the father of modern germ theory. And he believed that all of the great, you know, illnesses or diseases through time, like smallpox and yellow fever, and at his time, anthrax was a big deal, that all of those great diseases were from one organism, and they were evolving, and man just hadn't evolved immunity to it. And so his work was in sort of getting man to evolve that immunity faster. He only hired people in his lab who were evolutionists, Darwinists, if you will. And so this was a big deal. Now we know, because in the 1970s, his laboratory notebooks were made public, finally, and we found out that he made all of it up. He was a liar and a fraud throughout all of it. All of his research, even on vaccines, was completely made up. And so this idea of germ theory continues to live on, right? And people just continue to make it so, even though there's, believe it or not, there's no more evidence for germ theory than there is for the theory of evolution in the scientific literature. And because it's kind of entrenched in science, it just kind of stays there. And they wouldn't let you know that because they want you to think, because we're basically living in an expertocracy, they want you to think that they have everything completely and totally figured out. But I would submit to you that God's creation has a lot of secrets that we have yet to unfold, and we don't quite know everything about everything. So you see how this idea of evolution, it permeates even the discussion that we're having right now around the pandemic and all of the issues and problems that are part of society and so forth. All right. So the thing about science is that we're told that these people are the most rational and the most thoughtful people among us, right? They're the smartest people. And because they're smarter than us, they don't believe there is a God, right? Only dumb people believe in God. Let's be honest, okay? And they don't need that anymore. They tossed that off a long time ago, right? And so they're rational and thinking, and you know, if we're not going to be that way, then we need to just get out of the way and let them do their thing, because these people are the people who are really serious and intellectual. So, what they do is they get together and they write these papers to themselves and they publish them in their publications. And I already mentioned that the more elite your publication is, then the more true the thing that you wrote is, right? And so this is the way that science works. And by the way, you know, a lot of you here this morning, you don't know me, but I am a scientist, and I do science. I do science every day. I was trained to do science, and I was trained by people who do this type of thing, okay? And they take it very seriously, and they look down on people who believe in God, people who believe in creation, and they don't have anything good to say about them because you're basically the unfit if that's what you believe. So I want to show you an example of how that they deal. Now remember, one more thing before we move on. One more thing. We're talking about anxiety, right? What prompted me to talk about this was the anxiety that's going on in the world around us. And so I wanted to bring up this idea of the virus and show you how that it's framed out there in the world, okay? And so I'm going to show you something here in just a minute, and it's very unfortunate that masking is such a political thing. And so I'm not trying to make a political statement, and I really, really do not want to do that. I want to tell you up front that the quotes that I'm about to give to you are pro-mask, okay? And that's not necessarily my stance one way or the other. You can mask or not mask that, you know, that's totally up to you, and I'm not advocating one way or the other. But whenever I ran across this article, I had to put it in here because it perfectly illustrates the idea of anxiety and fear that we're talking about. And I want you to show how, and I want to show you how scientists deal with this. What do they have to deal with this, and how effective is it actually? Because remember, these are the smartest people. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in the spring. I think it was probably April. It may have been May. I can't remember exactly. So these are, remember, if it's published in a prestigious journal like the New England Journal of Medicine, it's more true, right? And so look at what they have to say about this. They start off by saying, and this is right at the very beginning of the article, "We know that wearing a mask outside healthcare facilities offers little, if any, protection from infection." Okay? That's the science. That's what they're saying. Here's the science. Here's the data. Here's the facts. We're scientists. We should follow the facts and the data wherever they take us, right? "We know that wearing a mask outside healthcare facilities offers little, if any, protection from the infection." And then they go on to say a couple sentences later, "In many cases, though, the desire for widespread masking is a reflexive reaction to anxiety over the pandemic." So there they go. They put it out. It's about fear, right? The data don't support it necessarily, but it's about fear. And then, so I put an ellipse there following that, but basically I cut out about 1,000 or 1,500 words where they're talking about the science and the data and why it is that masks don't work. And in fact, masks make infections spread faster in the general population. So if you want to spread an infection faster, get everybody to wear masks. This is what they were saying back then, okay? So I cut out all of that, and now we're going to the end, because what I'm really concerned about is what they think the solution should be. Is it to teach people the data or what? Look, notice what they say here. "Masks are visible reminders of an otherwise invisible yet widely prevalent pathogen, and may remind people of the importance of social distancing and other infection control measures." Now, did you catch what they just said? Do you understand the implication of what they just said? What they're saying is, one, there is an invisible yet omnipresent thing out there that is powerful. It's more powerful than you, and it has the power to destroy you. But if you perform this ritual, which isn't necessarily based in any sort of physical or meaningful thing, but if you perform this ritual, then you can be saved. And you will have these behaviors that will lead to a better life and your salvation. So do you see, now it's not looking so much like science. It's looking more like a religion, isn't it? What did I say earlier? They can't get away from religion, no matter how hard they try, because the fool has said inside himself there is no God. In fact, this whole idea of a ritual and this powerful, omnipresent thing is not unlike what we're doing here this morning, is it not? We have this ritual that we gather here to do, take the Lord's Supper, to remember someone who we can't see, but who is everywhere and all-powerful, and has the power to save us if we exhibit the right behaviors, right? The difference is that ours is unto life and theirs is unto death, right? Our invisible thing will save us and will give us life. Their invisible thing is going to kill them. Remember I said that evolution is all about death. Evolution and this idea of germ theory, it's a very disempowering and makes people helpless, victims of a situation that they can't control. But God has given us a spirit of power, has he not? And we'll look at that a little bit later on. So if you caught what they said here, then come up and get a sticker after services, because you're really, really sharp. But you see how they went from, hey, this is the facts, to this is, you know, how we feel about it, to, you know, we're going to alleviate anxiety with this physical thing. Not prayer, as we saw last week, not Thanksgiving and those other things. But they're not done. So the next sentence, it is also clear that masks serve symbolic roles. Masks are not only tools, they are also talismans that may help increase healthcare workers' perceived sense of safety, well-being, and trust in their hospitals. So if you wear a mask, then it will increase your faith. Right? That's what they just said. And it's a symbol. Lots of people have symbols, right? People wear crosses, or they have rosary beads, or they have a statue of Mary. A talisman, a good luck charm, like a lucky rabbit's foot, for example. Turn with me to Acts chapter 17. We're going to read a few passages now. Acts chapter 17. Look at verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you." Now the word there, too superstitious, okay? The word there, the Greek word, literally means superstitious. That's the best translation, direct translation into English. Some of the newer translations translate it religious for aesthetic reasons, because superstitious is kind of an older word. And so they skip the whole meaning in it, okay? Superstitious, if you look it up in the dictionary, it means to be religious but not know why. To be superstitious means to be religious but not know why. So what is a superstition? For example, carrying a lucky rabbit's foot. Who told you that that would bring you luck, and why? Where's the proof of that? Where did that truth come from? What about not crossing the path of a cat, of a black cat? Who told you? It's an old wives' tale, right? Where did that truth come from? Where is the proof? The things in the Bible are true, and that's the proof for why we live the way that we live. But where is the proof for living the way that science would have you to live, right? Where's the proof for the physical things that science would have you to do? He says they are religious and don't know why. Why? Because they ignorantly worship the unknown God. Okay? Masks are tools. They are also good luck charms that may increase your faith. Remember, we're talking about anxiety here. And the world's solution for anxiety, for getting rid of anxiety, is to do something physical. It's to do something physical. Next sentence. Although such reactions may not be strictly logical, we are all subject to fear and anxiety. Well, I would say we're not. If we cast our care upon God, as we saw last week, then you won't be subject, perpetually at least, to fear and anxiety, especially during times of crisis. One might argue that fear and anxiety are better countered with data and education than with a marginally beneficial mask. But it is difficult to get clinicians to hear this message in the heat of the current crisis. Expanded masking protocols' greatest contribution may be to reduce the transmission of anxiety, over and above whatever role they may play in reducing transmission of COVID-19. And this is true, okay? This is why anxiety is such a big deal. There is a lot of scientific evidence to show that anxiety is absolutely transmissible. And in fact, people can catch diseases without a pathogen present just because they're afraid they're going to. It's a very psychosomatic, mind-body relationship. There's a very tight mind-body relationship, and you can control your body with your anxieties and with your fears, or with your lack thereof. And so he says we should not, that this may not be strictly logical, because we are all subject to these things. Well, the Bible tells us in Romans 12 and 2, he says, which is your reasonable service. We are to commit our bodies, what? As a living sacrifice to God, which is our reasonable service. The word reasonable there is logikos in the Greek. It's where we get our word logic, right? Let's be logical. God tells us to be logical about what we do. Moving on from Acts chapter 17, turn to Colossians chapter 2. considering this idea of ineffectual good luck charms. And by the way, I realize that this is politically charged, and I do apologize for that. But I wanted to show you the world's solution for this. So I'm not trying to make a statement about masks per se. I'm just showing you what they're saying. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 20, considering this idea of ineffectual rituals, whereof if you be dead, verse 20, whereof if you be dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are you subject to ordinances? Touch not, taste not, handle not, which all are to perish with the using, after the commandments and doctrines of men, which things have indeed a show of wisdom, but only in will worship. Doesn't this sound like the world that we live in today? Touch not, taste not, handle not. Don't greet each other with a holy kiss, as we're commanded. Don't touch your brethren, right? So now we have this perspective of people are evil and they're trying to hurt me, right? And so I'm going to have to distance myself. And we talked about that at length last week and how the devil would love to divide us. One more passage, 2 Timothy chapter 4. I'm sorry, 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. And then notice what he says here. Having a form of godliness, that is, having a religion, some religion, but denying the power thereof, from such one turn away. These people, they have their religion, but they don't fully trust in it. And so people who are following after the wisdom of the world, you can't fully trust in that. Instinctively, you know that there's something else. That there's something else that you need. And so people who are following after the world will never be satisfied. So these people who look to the world for their religion, who look to the world for their faith, for their good luck charm, or whatever it is, they're never going to find it. It's not going to satisfy them and give them what they need. It will not alleviate their anxiety. But go on. He says here in verse 6, for of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women laden with sins, led away with divers lusts. How do they do that? With their old wives' tales, right? And they convince people to believe what they're teaching, even though it's not a real religion. And verse 7, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now, if this doesn't describe a modern, highly educated scientific researcher, I don't know what does. Ever learning, they're constantly reading, constantly making scientific observations, constantly publishing, constantly gaining knowledge, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. They never get there, right? And so science can't offer this to you. Science can't make this work for you. Science can't alleviate your anxiety. Only God can. Okay, I'm running short of time, so I'm going to run through the rest of this rather quickly. And for those of you who are in my class that was going on whenever all this started, then none of the rest of this will be news to you. But by the way, all of this, you know, I am running through really quickly. If you have any questions about any of this, come to me. I'm more than willing to talk to you. I have tons and tons more that I absolutely cannot fit. I could talk for days and days and days about any of this stuff. So if you have any questions about what I meant or anything I said, please come and talk to me. But if you go to the doctor and you say, hey, I'm really anxious. This whole pandemic thing, it's keeping me up at night. I'm really scared and I just can't function. What's he going to do? He's going to give you an anti-anxiety pill. Again, another fleshly answer to this. So is it working? Well, in the 1980s, we spent about $500 million. This is inflation corrected. $500 million on psych drugs. Today, we spend nearly $50 billion a year on psych drugs. And you would think that the more that we use these, that the better things would get. But it just doesn't seem to be that way. So why do they tell you? Well, if you think of things from the materialist perspective, right, that only material things exist and everything has to be described through physical process, then what they tell you is that, well, you have a chemical imbalance, too much dopamine, not enough serotonin, or whatever it is that they come up with. But the truth is that to date, there is absolutely no scientific evidence for any of that. And they admit that. So, for example, this is Ronald Pies, and he was the publisher, he was the editor at this journal called Psychiatric Times. It was the journal of one of the publications of the American Psychiatric Association. He said, in truth, the chemical imbalance notion was always a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. So in other words, we put out this hypothesis, it turns out it's not true, so now we're going to deny we ever thought it, right? This is absolutely the way that science works. I see this in my job all the time. It's almost laughable sometimes. But you see what he says here is always a kind of urban legend, like a old wives' tale or a superstition, right? Robert Whittaker, who's done a lot of writing on this. He's not a Christian, but he's done a lot of writing on this. And I encourage you, if you're really interested in this, that you should Google him, look him up on YouTube. Lots of talks. He has great websites, and he keeps them up to date with the current literature, the current scientific research on this. Before he realized the chemical imbalance notion was not true, he went to the top researcher at a large drug company and said, hey, I want to write a book about this chemical imbalance and all the progress that we've made over the last few decades. Can you point me to the scientific research on this? I'm having trouble finding it. And that researcher told him, Robert, that's just a metaphor that we tell people to get them to take the drugs. So metaphor sounds to me a lot like a parable, and now we're back to the whole religion thing, right? We're back to religion in the name of science. All of this permeates the way that we think, okay? So let me give you a few things to think about this. Here's a study called Relapse Prevention Therapy for Psychosis Patients, where they took patients who were mentally ill and they forced them to take the drugs. And not forced them, but they made sure they always took the drugs without fail. So what they found was increased medication compliance is associated with decreases in psychosocial functioning and increases in negative symptoms. So in other words, they got worse. What are the negative symptoms? Well, relapse. So in other words, they had another episode of whatever it was. Divorce. Divorce is very high among people who take these drugs. Unemployment, also crime, suicide, violence, and something called akathisia. So these things, divorce, unemployment, crime, suicide, violence, these are things we don't want people to go through as Christians, right? So we need to be showing them the Bible has the answer. And by the way, I'm not saying that mental illness is not real. It absolutely is real, and it is very difficult. People are hurting, though. And they're not getting the solutions that they need. Look up people who have done this. Go to YouTube, look up any of Robert Whittaker's stuff, and read the comments. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people talking about how these things have hurt them and ruined their lives. Over and over and over. Not a single comment. I read probably 10 videos. I read hundreds and hundreds. I never found anyone who was pro this because it ruined their lives. Akathisia, I don't have time this morning, unfortunately, to get into that. But akathisia is... It's where you basically lose your ability to stop yourself from doing things that are bad, and it's thought that almost all of the recent mass shooters were in a state of akathisia. But we do know that they were all on these drugs whenever they did that. And so akathisia is why is that? Why do you lose the ability to stop yourself from doing something bad? Why is it that these people have no remorse whenever they do it? It's because these drugs work exactly the same way alcohol does. They shut down the frontal lobe of your brain. And so these people are basically perpetually inebriated. I want to show you a little bit more data. Here's a study that the federal government did. So this was done by the federal government, where they looked at one-year outcomes of people who had taken the drugs. There were 4,041 people who took drugs for anxiety. This is specifically an anxiety study. 4,041 people. At the end of 1 year, only 108 had recovered. That is a recovery rate of less than 3%. It's about 2.5%. A recovery rate of 2.5%. Now, if you flip this and you look at people who never took the drugs, the recovery rate, depending on the study, is 85 to 97%. If you never take the drugs, within 1 year you'll be well. And almost 80% of those people, I think about 78%, will never have another episode if you never take the drugs. But it's a 95% chance that you will have another episode if you take the drugs. Why do they do this, you ask? Why? Because it has to be a physical reason. There has to be a physical reason for why people feel sad, for why they feel hurt, for why they feel fear. There has to be. Because we've already, a priori, just excluded the idea that there is a God and that people have control over themselves. Now, you understand the implications of this, right? The implications are, if this is true, the implications are that you have no control over who you are. You are a product of whatever it is that random evolutionary chance made you, and you have no hope. Boy, I know I'm running long, and so I want to remind you of naturalism. Let's look at a few verses. The key verse for this is Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 17, he says, "For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. These are contrary the one to the other, so that you cannot do the things that you would." So the word contrary there is opposite. The flesh and the spirit are opposite. You cannot have one and the other. It's like white and black. There's no white and black, and there's no black and white. They are opposite, good and bad. So these people who are hurting with these types of things, what is it that they need? Look at verse 22. "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith or trust, meekness, and self-control." The people who are hurting, they need love and peace and joy. You can only get that in the Spirit, not through the flesh. Some fleshly thing that a naturalist tells you that you need will not get you the fruit of the Spirit. Another verse, 1 Corinthians chapter 2. He says in verse 12, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God." So we don't have the spirit of the world, the spirit of the flesh. We have the Spirit of God. "Which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual." Don't listen to the things that the world teaches you. Don't listen to the solutions that the world has to a spiritual problem. Only the Holy Ghost can teach you that. Why? Because in verse 14, "But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned." The flesh can never understand the things of the Spirit. It's not possible. If you want the fruit of the Spirit, you have to do it God's way through the Holy Spirit. I have one more passage, which we're not going to read, in Luke chapter 21. I encourage you to read it in your own time, where Jesus says that to watch out because the day is coming. And if you are drunken, if you are inebriated, or you have the anxiety of the world, then you are not going to be ready. And we saw that last week, that it keeps you from being ready. And finally, one more passage, 2 Timothy chapter 1. Verse 7. "For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." God has not given us a spirit of fear, and the things of the world will never improve that fear. But God does not want you and me to be fearful. He wants us to be powerful. He wants us to have power. If we're looking for an answer for salvation in the things of the flesh, then it will only increase our fear, and it will not give us power. But God has given us the power to overcome these things through his love. And whenever you exercise that power and you cast off that fear, you will have the sound mind that he promises you in this verse. Power, love, and a sound mind. This is what we have to offer over the world. This is what we have to offer that is so much better. Christians caught up in anxiety cannot shine their light on the world. And I will tell you, my friends, that we are in all-out warfare. The devil is trying to bring people down, and the more fearful they are, the better, right? We are in all-out warfare, whether you know it or not, and whether you want to be in it or not. This is what is going on all around us. You cannot fight the war effectively if you're living in fear. And so I would encourage you this evening to look around you, understand the worldview of materialism and how it permeates our lives, and cast off your fear by praying to Him, giving it to Him, and He will take it from you because He cares for you. He will give you power and strength and a sound mind, and the devil will flee from you, right? Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So with that, this morning the lesson is yours, and I hope that you found it to be beneficial. I apologize that it was so long. That's always my problem, right? I always talk too much. So if you have any questions about any of this, please get with me, and I'll be more than happy to talk to you, especially about science. I love science, and I love helping Christians in that perspective. So if we can help you in any way, if you need the prayers of the congregation, if you need your life to be made right with God, we pray that you would take this opportunity and that you would cast your fear upon Him while we stand and sing.